This is the Trial Court Budget Working Group, the recommendation of new budget development and allocation methodology and action item. Our presenters are Presiding Judge Lori Earle, Judge Tom Boris, Presiding Judge Brian Walsh, Jake Chatters, and Sherry Carter. Welcome. Thank you. Before we start, I just remembered this. Thank you for that. We have several people who would like to speak on this. We welcome Presiding Judge Marcia Slough. Welcome. Superior Court of California, County of San Bernardino.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chief Justice, members of counsel. I come to you this morning first, Chief, to compliment you as well as Governor Brown for convening the Trial Court Funding Work Group. Their report that you just adopted clearly points out the issues that serve as the foundation for the item that is now on your agenda. I also wish to compliment Judge Earle for her extraordinary leadership in handling this issue, as well as the AOC staff, and the various court leaders that have worked so diligently on this critical issue for all of us. This morning, I speak to you from one of the under-resourced courts, one of many. San Bernardino County Superior Court has already implemented two separate phases of operational reductions as a result of the year after year after year budget cuts. These cuts, which are laid on top of the historic and inequitable system of allocating money to the courts. Each phase has resulted in us having to close courthouses and courtrooms, lay off employees, and stop and eliminate very critical services for our citizens. As it relates to employees, the statewide standards show that we should have 1,500 employees to handle our files in our county. As of May 3rd, which is 1 week from today, we will have fewer than 900. With regard to the closures, we now have people in our county that have to drive over 2.5 hours one way to get to the closest open court. The report that was just presented to you clearly pointed out that when we have citizens that are driving over 200 miles to get to a courthouse, clearly access to justice is challenged. And we're not done yet. We still have not closed in our county our budget gap. Come fiscal year 14-15, we still are facing an almost $11 million hole. And that situation leads me to a few key points. First, the cuts to all of our courts have been way too deep. Secondly, the historic model of allocating the money to the 58 counties has resulted in severe disparity. For example, we have counties, courts that have almost the identical workload, and yet one will get twice the money than the other. And on the other side of that coin, we have county courts that have the same amount of money allocated to them almost, and yet one does half the workload. The negative impacts of this type of disparate treatment fall way too heavily on the residents of the under-resourced courts. The proposed model that comes before you today will help. It is based on workload, and even though it will take several years to be fully implemented, it will, with time, improve our delivery of justice to our residents. Finally, even with the new model, our court, as I stated, faces a multi-million dollar shortfall come July 1, 2014. The new workload model will offset a portion of that deficit. But because the state plans to sweep our reserve come June 30, 2014, we will have no method to close the gap except for implementation of phase three of our reductions. And that means more closures and more layoffs. I fear that when that point comes, and that's just 14 months away, that our county will have indeed reached its tipping point, the point at which the number of our courtrooms and our remaining staff simply will be wholly insufficient to handle the cases being filed, and thousands of our citizens will have no reasonable access to a courthouse. I am here, Chief and Counsel, to wholeheartedly recommend that you adopt the model that will soon be presented to you. My other ask is simply that we cannot for one moment believe that the model is in and of itself the only answer. We must continue to work with the governor and the legislature to restore funding, as well as to ask them to reconsider the sweep of our reserves, which is a tool for managing through these difficult times. This day cannot be your end of your fight. It will not be the end of my fight for the battle of justice for all of us before the cornerstone of justice is swept out from more of us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Presiding Judge Slough. Next, we'll hear from Presiding Judge David P. Warner.
Good morning, Chief and members of the Council. I appreciate the opportunity to address you this morning regarding the proposed workload-based allocation and funding methodology that's being presented. This new allocation system is a key to the financial survival of the San Joaquin Superior Court. Since the enactment of the Lockyer-Eisenberg Trial Court Funding Act of 1997, we've been stuck in a pro rata historic allocation process. For over 15 years, the inequity of that system has been perpetuated. It has rewarded some courts from a monetary standpoint and punished others. San Joaquin has been one of those hurt with a lack of financial resources. When I refer to well-resourced courts and under-resourced courts, I'm referring to the financial relationship of one trial court to another. I acknowledge that all the courts are struggling due to budget cuts and do not have the resources required to deliver a proper justice system. That being said, some courts clearly get a better shake when it comes to revenue distribution, some getting millions of dollars more to do the same work as other courts. I witnessed the hours spent on developing the new proposed model. I need to take a moment and thank and congratulate Judge Earl for the work and effort that she put in and the result of that effort, which is being presented to you here today. She was instrumental in moving the process forward, being able to keep people on task and moving it forward through that process. We are pleased with the result and thank her and the entire subcommittee for their effort. The implementation of that new methodology is a different matter, however. Before you is a recommendation to phase the new model in over 5 years and then only to 50%. It requires more money from the state to fully implement the system. The risk of using a phased-in approach is that over time it may not get fully implemented. This was our experience with RAS, the old RAS model. It was used for about 3 years to supplement funding to under-resourced courts and then was found to be flawed, outdated, old, and was never used again as a funding tool. We've been waiting for 15 years for a fair process, and now that we can see it and it's in our grasp, if we phase it in over the time system being suggested, it really won't provide much benefit, at least not now. We're told that this phase-in is necessary to allow the well-funded courts to adjust. There are other options. Our request is to fully implement the methodology now and allow those courts taking cuts to apply for supplemental funding if they face a deficit, just like we were told to do. If that's acceptable, an acceptable process for under-resourced courts, why is it not acceptable for the better-resourced courts? We can make the CART process available to them as well. Beyond the five-year phase-in, the remaining 50% of the system relies on hundreds of millions of dollars of new state funding to put the model fully into operation. We feel like we're being held hostage to the state. We have no way of knowing if or when the state will actually provide more funding to the branch. In the meantime, we simply have to wait. What happens if the state doesn't come up with that money? Apparently, the under-resourced courts would again be locked into that old inequitable pro rata funding system where they are hurt financially year after year. It does not sound like a fair system. The bottom line is that only 50% of what Lockyer Eisenberg intended is put into place, depending on what the state does. An additional reason for the slow phase-in is the need to for under-resourced courts to figure out what to do with the new resources. I'm taken back by the argument. We are under-resourced, not stupid. We can use the money. We need it now. We will find ways to use it wisely, including getting all of our case types moving again. I'd like you to think for a moment about this question. If I were to be followed by the state and they were to tell this branch that they were going to completely eliminate the cuts to provide over $1 million in missing funding to the courts, what would your response to that be? State, we appreciate what you're offering, but you need to wait. We need time to think about this. How about we phase it in over 5 years, and after 5 years, we'll only be to 50%. That way, we'll be able to use the money wisely. Is that the response we would give? Not likely. You would give the response, and appropriately so, that all funding should be restored immediately. That's our answer to the same question. Even if the new funding methodology is put in place in total, we would not be back to where we were with our funding.
1 minute.
We do know what to do with the money. Allocate to us what is fair. The present proposal also recommends that all new money received be allocated according to the new methodology. Why continue to increase funding to the better funded courts at the expense of the underfunded, severely underfunded courts? Why not provide all of the new money to the most severely under-resourced court, whoever that is, and continue to build them up and then others until they've gotten up to proper financing? All we ask is to be treated fairly, that you provide us and each trial court with the resources commensurate with the workload that they're expected to complete. We've heard for years how our financial position is unfair and that the system needs to be fixed. We are asking you to fix it now, not 5 years from now, not 10 years from now, but now. We thank you for taking the time to hear the arguments of a historically and severely under-resourced court. And I want to remind you, we do need your help. Thank you.
Thank you, Presiding Judge Warner. That ends our public comment. Judge Earl, Presiding Judge Earl.
Thank you, Chief. I do have to say that the previous presenter stole most of my material, so I'll tailor my comments a little differently, and you've heard some of them before. As you know, until 1997, the primary responsibility for funding California's trial courts fell upon the state's 58 counties. Individual trial court budgets were dependent upon the financial health and decision-making of their county governments. As a result, court services varied from county to county, leading to disparities in the administration of justice. In his 2001 State of the Judiciary Address, Chief Justice Ronald George described the inequity of the county funding structure as follows. Disparities in the quality of justice dispensed across the state were common and erratic. Local courts were on the verge of closing, with staff cutbacks and unfunded payrolls, facilities in a state of dangerous disrepair, services to the public drastically curtailed, and ultimately, the entire administration of justice at risk. Sound familiar? In the early 1990s, in an effort to provide more stable funding to the trial courts, the judicial branch began to advocate for a system of statewide funding. And with the enactment of the Trial Court Funding Act in 1997, the primary responsibility for trial court funding shifted from the counties to the state. In its September 2001 report entitled Completing the Goals of Trial Court Realignment, the California Legislative Analyst Office stated that Chapter 850, which was the Trial Court Funding Act, was intended mainly to provide a mechanism that would ensure adequate funding levels for trial courts and thereby ensure equal access to justice across the state. The level of funding that each trial court received when the state assumed funding responsibilities was based upon the amount of funding courts had received from their counties in fiscal year 1994-95. Under the funding methodology in place since that time, the Judicial Council has allocated baseline funding to the trial courts based upon historical allocations. During this period, despite divergent rates of population, caseload, and local cost growth, historical base funding levels have not been adjusted to reflect these specific changes on a court-by-court basis. In 2013, a little more than 10 years since the enactment of the Act, the state of California is in the throes of a sustained period of economic crisis. As a result, trial courts are once again curtailing services to the public. The timing and consistency in which trial courts have reduced services or access has been difficult to predict. While the fiscal crisis has affected all 58 courts, the impact has been erratic, affecting different courts in different ways, at different times, and some more deeply than others. While most of the 58 trial courts have implemented employee layoffs, others have had to go further by closing courtrooms and, in some cases, full courthouses. At a time when resources are scarce, it has become evident that the disparity of funding that existed under the county funding model has not been corrected with the current state-funded system, and historical differences in resources have once again amounted to disparities in outcome for court users. Recognizing the need to remedy funding inequities, our subcommittee was formed last November to address this issue. The subcommittee consists of 16 members, 7 presiding judges, and 9 court executive officers from counties of variable size, geographic location, and funding need. The charge of the subcommittee was to develop a trial court funding model that would result in a more equitable distribution of trial court funding among each of the 58 courts. What has emerged from these efforts is a recognition that whatever models are used to categorize or assess needs, a more comprehensive budget process is required to make reasoned and deliberate funding decisions. On behalf of the subcommittee, we are honored to bring forth a recommendation that represents a trial court budget process that will result in a more transparent and equitable distribution of trial court funding. It is a step-by-step budget development and allocation process which allows each of the 58 trial courts to determine their baseline funding needs. It is important to note that we have presented our proposal to our colleagues up and down the state in a series of regional presiding judge and court executive officer meetings that occurred on March 25th, March 29th, and April 2nd. We have presented our proposal to the trial court funding work group on March 26th. We have presented our proposal to the California State Bar and Open Courts Coalition, and just 1 week ago, we presented in 3 different sessions to legislative representatives, members of the Department of Finance, Governor's Office, and Legislative Analyst Office, organized labor, and our justice partners. And on April 9th, we presented our recommendation to the Trial Court Budget Working Group, which unanimously approved, save one abstention, the proposed methodology. We are eager to bring it to you for approval today. I want to tell you a little bit about the proposal before we walk you through some graphs and spreadsheets. The budget process that we propose involves 2 steps: budget development procedures that would demonstrate a calculable formula and protocol for achieving relative parity, and allocation procedures that allow specific approaches and that would make allowances for recognized adjustments. The budget development process is rooted in workload measurements based on the work of the SB 56 Working Group in updating the resource assessment study. The assessment study is based on the one constant each trial court has, case filings. The study, as you know, involved time studies of filings data to estimate staff workload need for 20 different case types averaged over a rolling 3-year period. Although the resource assessment study forms the foundation for the proposed methodology, that study does not capture all of the work of the courts, nor account for all courts' costs, and is not intended by itself as a funding model. Thus, our proposed methodology builds upon the assessment study, attempting to account for all the costs or cost drivers associated with the work of the trial courts, allowing for the opportunity for trial courts to request adjustments to their allocation in circumstances where the methodology does not account for certain workload or operational costs, and accounting for costs of labor differentials across varying counties. It is important to note that the proposed methodology is designed to maintain existing trial court funding structures. First, the methodology does not alter a court's ability to make independent decisions on how they allocate funds within their own court. While the application of the methodology may limit the amount of funds a trial court receives based upon workload needs and cost of labor differentials, the model does not tell courts how they must spend their money, including how much they should pay their employees. Each court will continue to receive a lump sum allocation and are still free to spend it how they choose. The methodology also incentivizes courts to be more efficient. For example, if the workload study for a particular court identifies the need for 10 full-time equivalent employees, and that court has figured out a way to perform that particular work with fewer employees, they would be able to allocate the funding they receive for those 10 employees to other areas of their operations where perhaps more resources are needed. Trial courts thus maintain local authority and accountability for spending. Lastly, the methodology maintains the authority for trial courts to carry forward fund balances, whatever they may be, at the end of each fiscal year. The allocation methodology is premised on identifying funding need for court operations and then comparing that amount to available funding. Application of the new methodology would require shifts in current baseline funding from some courts to others. For example, those courts whose proportion of statewide funding is less than their workload need and below the statewide average funding need would see an increase in their allocation. These are approximately 23 courts, most notably the superior courts in the counties of Kings, Imperial, Riverside, San Bernardino, San Joaquin, San Luis Obispo, and Stanislaus. There are 18 courts whose proportion of the statewide funding is below their workload need, but greater than the statewide average funding need. Thus, while these courts are identified as needing additional funding, their need, relatively speaking, is not as great as other courts, and they would see a reduction in their allocation. Among these courts includes the counties of Alameda, Contra Costa, Fresno, Mendocino, Orange, San Diego, San Francisco, San Mateo, Santa Clara, and Sacramento. In light of the impact of these shifts in baseline funding, you will see that we recommend that the use of the methodology be phased in over a five-year period of time. In a moment, I will turn it over to Jake to walk you through the proposed model. But before I do, I want to address one very important component of the methodology, one that we are continuing to refine, and that is a component that the working group believes critical to the proposed model, and that's the recognition of cost of labor differentials across each of the 58 counties. One of the calculations necessary under the proposed methodology is an estimation of salary needs of each court. Our subcommittee firmly believes that equity would not be served by allowing for a court to receive funds for actual costs of salaries. At a time when trial court funding has been considerably reduced over the last 5 years, paying for the actual salary costs for some court could effectively deplete the funding available for other courts. Instead, a calculation of average salary of each court was determined, and then a cost of labor adjustment using the most accurate and available data on the wages of local government employees in each county was applied. In applying a cost of labor adjustment, it was determined that data compiled by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics appears to be the most comparable, accurate, and justifiable data. But you will also hear today that there's some refinement that we need to do on the application of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And that is what we will begin doing immediately after the council meeting. Let me just say that we are confident in the integrity of the proposed methodology and in the implementation schedule, but it is not perfect. There are a number of refinements, fine-tuning, if you will, that need to be made to move the methodology closer to perfection, and our recommendation contemplates that. Without a doubt, however, the proposed workload-based allocation and funding methodology provides for allocations based on identifiable metrics and provides each a much greater equity in allocations of each of the 58 trial courts. So I will turn it over to Jake Chatters to walk you through a graph of the proposed model.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Chief and the Council. I have the pleasure of walking you through what we call our bubble chart, which means for those of you that like algebra, you'll be very happy. And for those that don't enjoy it quite so much, I hope you'll forgive me. So to start on the chart in front of you, we start with step one, and this is how to develop the overall budget for the trial court needs throughout the state. And in the top left corner under step one, in what is sort of an orangish color, talks about establishing our FTE need. And as Judge Earl mentioned, this component of the process relies essentially today exclusively on the work of the SB 56 Working Group and the Resource Assessment Study as adopted by your council in February. And so that measure, which has been worked on for many years, the latest iteration for about 5 years, through input of thousands of employees of this state and the judicial branch, and through the hard work of the SB 56 Working Group and the Office of Court Research, is a FTE calculation based on a weighted caseload model so that those courts that see a higher percentage of felonies see a higher FTE need than those courts that have a higher percentage of infractions. And as you know, and has been discussed previously, that's important. For my court in Placer County, compared to statewide, we have a lower proportion of infraction cases than does the statewide average. And so a simple measure that looked at total caseload as a single number would harm our court in some way by not recognizing the fact that we have a larger caseload of felonies and unlimited civil cases than we do for infractions. And so that first step takes the work of the SB 56 Working Group. It uses a 3-year weighted average filings in those 20 case categories that Judge Earl alluded to, and does a simple mathematic calculation of number of minutes per case type times the average number of filings for that court to come up with a number of FTEs. That FTE number is for what we call, and what we all call in our courts, Program 10, which are operations staff. Those are our clerks in our clerk's office, our courtroom clerks in the courtroom, our court reporters, our legal research attorneys, our mediators, our child custody recommending counselors, our probate investigators. It then adds to that, based on a factor, the number of Program 90 staff, which are our accountants and HR professionals, our administrators, and also adds on a supervisor factor based on the number of FTEs. That number gives you an FTE count, and one thing we want to be very cautious of in explaining is that you can't use that FTE count as a comparison to a court directly based on how many positions they have filled today. As Judge Earl said, and as we all know, as each individual court, we make decisions about how we can best meet the needs in our jurisdiction, and in some cases that means having more of one classification than another because that's simply what we need that may be different from the model. For us in the smaller courts, the model may say that I need a fraction of an FTE for a probate investigator. It may not be reasonable for me to hire a portion of an FTE, and so I may use a contract firm or a contractor to perform that function. As a result, if you compare it to my actual number of FTEs, you can't compare the two numbers directly because it might say I need 200 employees, but I only have 150 because I need to provide some of those services in a different way. And that is why you lead to the next step, which looks at how to convert that FTE count to dollars. Since strictly an FTE number isn't a good comparison, we do have a way to convert that FTE need, which is essentially how many FTEs you would need should you choose to use FTEs to complete the work at hand. And we convert that to a dollar value. There are a number of calculations that go into that process. It does use today recognizing the fact that we bargain locally and that we have no intent through this model to change that structure. It respects the local bargaining environment that we have today. That this takes our average salaries as they are today, plus the benefits that we pay today on a per FTE basis for health benefits, vision, dental, and factors in our current and existing retirement costs, since as you're aware, those are based on our county retirement systems and aren't changeable, and uses those existing costs today to multiply by the FTE need. That provides us a dollar amount that then is adjusted, as we call it, with a moderating factor, as Judge Earl alluded to, using the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So we use a comparison of what that salary number looks like compared to the Bureau of Labor Statistics to see some degree of moderating factor, right, that we need to have some, a dollar in Alpine County is different than a dollar in Santa Clara County. and that measure is a way to adjust for that factor. We apply that BLS only to salary. We do not apply it to health benefits because the BLS does not factor in health benefits. It only looks at salary. Are you with me so far? Mm-hmm. Okay. So that gets you to a dollar amount, and that says how much do I need in dollars for my staff, for my courtroom clerks, my clerks in the clerk's office, for our managers or supervisors, our accountants, our IT professionals. That does not yet include the next bubble, the next blue bubble, which is our cost for subordinate judicial officers, for our commissioners and referees. So as it stands today, this we add in for each court their actual cost based on their authorized subordinate judicial officer positions, because that is a need. If those aren't filled, that is not relevant, though the need in that court is for all of those authorized positions to be filled. We add that dollar amount in, and that gets you that yellow box on the right, which is, we label it PC, but that's just personnel costs. And that's the total personnel costs necessary for each court to meet their operations needs. So let me give one caveat that I skipped over. That operations need doesn't include everything. It doesn't include interpreters. It doesn't include additional costs as they relate to criminal justice realignment, AB 109, because that occurred after the workload model was developed, and so those costs aren't included. It doesn't include costs for child support, AB 1058, because it has a separate funding source. Our jury costs, for example, aren't included because those are a reimbursement. So I'll talk through some of that later. But this is fundamentally our core operations costs are accounted for in the PC bubble. Going down to the next line on step two, we just carry that dollar amount forward. And we add to it in the red bubble operating expenses. And this is a factor for each court based on its FTE need from the prior calculation. What we did as a group is looked through the general ledger accounts, all the detailed accounting data that will bore you, and we'll go through it line by line, certainly. But every account that courts spend in operating expenses, we reviewed, and we reviewed them for a couple of purposes. One was to determine that because we make local decisions, in some cases, my operating expense may already be captured in that FTE calculation in line one. We want to make sure we don't double count and therefore exaggerate the cost that it is to operate the court. We went line by line, removed those costs to ensure that we had a reliable amount of money for operating expenses. One of the pieces that we like to clarify for those outside of our branch is that you can't take a look at a private company or even another government agency and say, what is an average cost for operating expenses in corrections or in the DMV, and compare it to us in the court system. Because we have some of our operating costs are case-driven costs, psychological examinations, as a big example. Those are things that other jurisdictions aren't, or other entities aren't going to have, and so we need to make sure that we provide sufficient funding for us and to address case-related expenses that occur in the adjudication of cases. So we took the total amount of those operating expenses and created a factor per FTE that would be added to each court. We used two separate numbers. One is larger for the Cluster 1 courts, our two-judge courts throughout the state. They tend to, because they're smaller, they still have some base level costs that we all have. You buy software. In many cases, there is a base level cost for software and an incremental additional cost per FTE. Well, for those small courts, they still have that base cost. And as a result, we use a higher factor, which I think Sherry will get to later, for the Cluster 1 courts than exist for the rest of the courts in the state. Next to that, we then add in what are called the unique factors. No model can entirely address everything that we do every day. It does its best, but there are some things that simply the model can't handle, either due to lack of data or complexity. And we contemplated a process by which courts would be able to submit to a group, so far undefined, and say, I have a special circumstance that needs to be addressed. Those are what we call the unique factors. There are three primary elements of that. The first is case mix within the 20 categories. So we have 20 categories that we measure workload on, and that's quite a bit. But even within those, for a felony, for example, a death penalty case is different than a not death penalty case that may still be a felony. And so we want to allow a process that if there is a jurisdiction that has a higher proportion of death penalty cases, there is a way for them to request additional funding through this process. The second is locations, and I'll use myself as an example. We have our main facilities are in Roseville and in Auburn, and then we have a small facility up on the north shore of Lake Tahoe. And that facility has four staff, but even though it has four staff, it's over 100 miles away, and so it does need management personnel there to deal with management issues. The model may not, again, sufficiently address that issue, and I may want to request a special circumstance and say, I need some additional funding to deal with this need of my community that is not in the main population center. So that's a second. And then a third is escaping me at the moment. It relates to the BLS factor. And then in some circumstances, there may be some very unique needs related to salary structures in a court. And at this point, we're allowing for there may be some way that we need to address that through this process. That due to local labor dynamics, there may be a need for a court to identify a special circumstance for them. So as of now, those are the three that would fall into this category. Acknowledging that we want to implement something for 13-14, this process can't be implemented in the year for 13-14. We don't have the structure set up, but it is contemplated for the future. Adding all those numbers together gets you to that purple-ish bubble there, the trial court baseline costs for a specific court using state funds. Thanks, Stephen. The next step is we need to add in this big green sort of large bubble here. Includes costs that have dedicated state funding sources. That is our security costs for those courts that still have them, dependency court appointed counsel, jury reimbursement, interpreters, AB 1058, and AB 109 costs. And so these are things that the judicial council has other allocation methods for that you've used, and so we aren't contemplating changing those. We acknowledge why those exist and that those need to be added in as part of the statewide costs. That gets to our red box there, which then follows down to step four. For each local court, however, we have other costs that are funded by local revenue. Our enhanced collection staff is probably the biggest single item. Those are funded by local revenue, not state revenue. But if you're trying to identify the total cost that it takes to run the court system in the state, we would, of course, want to address that and add in those costs from local revenue sources. And that gets you to that next bubble there. It's labeled total trial court baseline costs. And essentially, in this year, we would end there. But for future years, we have step five, which adds in another little purple bubble there that talks about approved one-time costs and BCPs. So there may be circumstances where a court has certainly one-time costs, whether it's technology or infrastructure of some kind, and we need to have a process to address those going forward. So this contemplates adding that, which then gets you to the yellow bubble here of the trial court budget need for a particular year. Go ahead to the next slide, Stephen. So then we get to what we would ask of the state, right? So if you have your chart in front of you, you'll see this sort of reddish box. I think it's red. The total trial court baseline costs was not the last bubble you saw. It goes back a few steps because we want to make sure we're not including local revenue. But you would take those baseline costs and add to it the sum of any approved one-time budget change proposals. And that would then look like here is what we need for a given year to sufficiently run the trial courts of this state from state funds. And that gets you to our gray box. Any questions for me on this bubble chart methodology?
I have one. When you talk about the unique circumstances, you say it's not going to be, excuse me, Terry Jackson from San Francisco, it's not going to be implemented for 13-14, is that correct? But sometime in the future?
Correct. So because the budget process is a lengthy process, there isn't time for courts to prepare. You know, we need to prepare that process. What does it look like? What do you need to submit? Who does it get submitted to? And courts would need time to prepare those documents and that justification. And just being realistic, we're in April. To turn those around in 2 months isn't going to be feasible on any of us to be able to meet that requirement.
And then back to your unique factors, when would that be proposed? When a court would, for instance, has handle complex litigation, and that's not being included, or even though you're looking at filings, but not the actual how many of those filings are going to trial, mm-hmm. and say a court has a situation where 80% of their filings are going to trial in the criminal division, would that be a unique factor, and when could that be presented?
So on the complex cases are included now. So complex civil cases are a separate workload measure. However, your point about if a court has a, I don't know what the trial percentage is across the state, but if a court has a higher percentage of cases going to trial than does another court, I think the short answer there is no, the model doesn't include that. One of the items that's in the parking lot that we'll get to later is looking at how do we fold in and can we fold in other measures besides filings that may be some metrics of some kind that look at those types of things that wasn't specifically contemplated as part of the ongoing that unique factor calculation, but instead, as I know, we need to look at globally about how do we address other items. How do you fold those into this type of model? So that is on the parking lot.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I do think, though, it could be a unique factor. If there was, say, a district attorney with a particular policy on whether how to handle or not handle cases, it could fit into the unique factors. But we have a vision that, in jointly with the Judicial Council and the Trial Court Budget Working Group, that would be the group that would establish, like, what form you need to fill out, what sort of criteria, kind of like the process used for the 2% funding.
Thank you.
So next we will talk a little bit about what our specific recommendation is in terms of adoption and implementation of the model. And I will tell you that, quite frankly, we would have loved to have been able to come to you and say, beginning in fiscal year 14-15, we think that the model should be implemented at that time. But we honestly believe we don't have the time to wait, that we have to do something in fiscal year 13-14, and that this is a precursor, I believe, to seeing any further reinvestment in the trial courts, is to make sure that the other branches of government and that the public understand our budget development process and understand where the money that the branch gets is going. And so we do recommend a phased-in approach. And as you've heard, we haven't had the time to fully fine-tune that unique factor process. I fully expect that will be developed and ready for use in fiscal year 14-15, but it would need to be ready by August or sooner as the budget development procedures begin. So in walking through the recommendations, the first recommendation that we bring you is to approve the workload-based allocation and funding methodology for use in allocating the annual state trial court operation funds, consistent with an implementation schedule that I'll walk you through, but also with the understanding that the ongoing technical adjustments to the methodology will continue to be evaluated by the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee, and that those adjustments will be submitted to the Judicial Council for approval. So, for example, I think we all are in agreement, but we haven't put pen to paper, that the unique factor process probably should be that you make that request, you submit that request to the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee, who then makes a recommendation to approve or not approve to the Judicial Council. We would come back to the council when we have established that process. The second recommendation that we bring is to direct the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee to provide annual updates of the methodology beginning with the April 2014 council meeting. We also recommend that you adopt a 5-year implementation schedule for the methodology as outlined below. In the first year, first we address the $261 million in unallocated reductions that trial courts still must absorb. And our recommendation is that continue to be allocated under current historical pro rata methodology. And the reason for that is this is a reduction we've all known about since January and have all planned, all courts have planned and prepared their budget plans around these numbers. And for your benefit, you can see on Appendix F of our report, beginning at page A33, is the computation of the estimated $261 million ongoing reduction. These are the reductions that the percentage and the dollar amounts reduction with each of the trial courts will be receiving in light of this $261 million. And we recommend that it be allocated under current historical model. We then recommend a phased-in approach to the new methodology. Beginning in fiscal year 13-14, we recommend that a 10% of a trial court's allocation be allocated pursuant to the methodology and 90% be allocated pursuant to historical-based funding methodology. I will tell you then in the course of our deliberations, in the course of our meetings, in the course of our many discussions, this was by far the most boisterous discussion about how and when we should implement the model. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, we did consider exactly what Judge Warner has brought before you today, that we should should we immediately turn to the new funding methodology and abandon the historical pro rata methodology? But we recognize that there are significant dangers in doing that. Our transition to the new model will not completely close the gap that Judge Slough talks about. We need new money to do that. But it's a step towards that. And what we've done is we've identified what is the average statewide funding need and where do courts fall along those averages. There are some courts who are funded above the average, and there are some courts who are funded beneath below the average. And our intent was not to bring everybody down below the average, nor was our intent to flip those on top with those on the bottom. And quite candidly, if we were to implement this new model 100% on July 1, we would simply flip the position of some courts who are underfunded with those courts who are woefully underfunded. Let me give you an example. If we were to immediately implement the new model, when you consider the $261 million reduction we still have to absorb, you would have counties like Alameda who would suddenly face a reduction in their budget of $26 million by July 1 of this year. Orange County, $41 million. San Diego, $39 million. Fresno, $7 million. So that is the danger of saying we're going to proceed by allocating completely under our new model. The risk is you take those courts and you just shift positions. We're just shifting money amongst ourselves. We're robbing Peter to pay Paul. And really the five-year implementation schedule is to allow us to glide into parity. We also had a very boisterous discussion about whether or not we should end at 50% allocation or should we take it all the way to 100%. And we firmly believe that we should not take it to 100% because, again, you have the same result. Courts would be switching positions with each other. If there were no new money introduced, we'd be in trouble. We'd be coming before you today now saying we need to do something to save Orange County, who's now woefully underfunded. So we recognize that this doesn't close the gap immediately and that there are concerns about the pace of the implementation schedule. But we believe that an implementation schedule is necessary to do two things, and not just in the first year, but over the whole 5 years that we recommend. If we were not to lay out an implementation schedule, courts would have insufficient opportunity to plan for future fiscal years. So although we recommend a 10-90 split in year one, if we were to stop there, courts would have no opportunity to plan. But the bigger danger of not going forward in a five-year implementation schedule as we propose is we send a message potentially to the executive and legislative branches that we're not real committed beyond the first fiscal year. If what we say is the first fiscal year we recommend 10 and 90, but after that let us figure it out, I think the problem is that perhaps our credibility is subject to attack. When we ran the data and that's encompassed in the spreadsheets that you have before you, and I want to say the caveat to that is the numbers are not final on those spreadsheets, as we are still fine-tuning that cost of labor application or the use of that index against salaries and average salaries among each court. We still need to fine-tune that before the numbers are final, and we'll bring that back to you when we've done that with final allocations in July. But we also recognize when we ran the numbers that there was an anomaly that impacted the smallest courts in our county, and these are the two-judge courts that RAS calls Cluster 1 courts, which is how I now view each of you. I see you and I think, oh, you're a Cluster 1 court. Oh, you're a Cluster 1 court. So there was an anomaly in that 14 out of those 15 small courts would receive a reduction to their allocation, and we knew that that wasn't right. The amount of money this involved was about $450,000, so we decided the best thing to do was to keep them out of the model the first year. And we committed to ourselves and to those small courts that we will immediately begin focusing on how the application impacts, how the application of the methodology impacts that smaller courts. We will invite them to participate as we delve into how the application impacts the smaller courts. And when we have reached consensus on how to apply the model to the small courts, we will come back before you and request that they be included, but not until we have figured that out. In future fiscal years, you will see that we slowly implement the model over a phased-in approach until we get to fiscal year 17-18, which we will finally be at that 50% split of new money allocation under the new model and the old model. But we also took into account the hope and the possibility that we see reinvestment in the judicial branch and how we would we allocate money that came in as new money. Our recommendation is that any new money that's appropriated for general trial court operations be allocated completely under the new workload model. And for every dollar that we receive of new money, we also recommend that we dip into what we call old money, and rather than allocate that under the split that we've laid before you, we match and allocate that 100% under the new model. So let me give you an example. We have a spreadsheet that demonstrates that. If we were to get just $100 million in reinvestment in the trial courts, we would not only allocate that under the new workload model, but we would take $100 million of old money and allocate that under the new model as well. So you can see that we quickly get away from the historical-based pro rata methodology with the infusion of new money. Is that the end of my slides? And I invite my colleagues to comment on our recommendation, including the implementation schedule, if you'd like to, before we move on.
All right. Did you want me to go to parking lot?
Wouldn't.
Afterwards?
Yeah.
Okay. Afterwards. Well, thank you, Chief Justice, members of the council. I'm Brian Walsh. I've had the honor to be a part of the subcommittee working with Judge Earle and others at this table and throughout the branch on this new funding methodology. I can tell you that the work of the subcommittee was thorough. It was fair. It was a lot of hard work, but we were ably led by Judge Earle, who brought us through these difficult issues by consensus on an incredibly short time schedule. When we started in November, nobody believed that we could have a new allocation model ready for the fiscal year 14-15. And then when we were in March, we found out, no, that's not the target. The target is suddenly 13-14. How are we going to get there? Well, we did, and it was a great credit to Judge Earle and to our group that we achieved that. It was a great group. Everyone, of course, represented the court, but they were there representing the branch, and they put the interests of the individual courts aside. And, yes, we had to hurry. And so what we bring before you is not perfect. But, you know, it's better than good. It is, in fact, the best. If you adopt this, the state of California will have the best, the most thorough, the most specific trial court funding allocation model in the United States. We have talked to the National Center for State Courts at length. Of course, we have our own experts on our group. This will be the best that's out there if you adopt it. It'll be, I'd like to think of it as the E equals MC squared of trial court allocation. But it's a work in progress. Because of the shortened deadline, many issues were moved to a parking lot, which I'll discuss in a moment. And we have committed ourselves, if you adopt this, to immediately turning to those phase two issues. If I may, while I have the floor, I'd like to address two issues that have come up during these discussions. One, in the media, I've read reports of wealthy courts or that this is a Robin Hood method that we're taking from the rich courts and giving to the poor courts. No way. We on our subcommittee have been studying trial court budgets of the 58 courts for the last 5 months. I can assure you, we can assure you, there are no rich courts. There are underfunded courts, like Santa Clara County, Orange County, and there are woefully underfunded courts, like Riverside and San Bernardino, and then there's some in between, like Sacramento or Los Angeles. You think of this not as Robin Hood, but like an old black and white movie from the Great Depression. It's sort of two people out of luck, but one slightly better off than the other, and it reaches into a pocket to hand a quarter to the guy who's really hurting. So it's not Robin Hood. It's he's not heavy. He's my brother. This is the spirit of this, which is we know we're in a branch together. We have to run our own courts, but we know we have to reach out and help. But that leads to the other issue. I don't like this. I don't like a process that gives our court 2 months' notice that we're going to be out another $2 million. I know that some courts that are woefully underfunded don't like it to know that we've gone through all this and they only end up with a net gain of maybe $2 million. But what I really don't like is we've been told by the legislature and the governor that the purse strings are their job, that they set the amount of money, and yes, they do. And what I don't like, then, is when a branch is woefully underfunded generally, that we are expected to just move money around and solve it. If we're underfunded, we need more money. Therefore, it's the branch that needs to step forward. And if they do, as Judge Earle explained, we have created a process whereby any reinvestment is supercharged to get out to the new, to the woefully underfunded courts. When we finished this process and we got in on time during the middle of March, I can assure you we finally voted by consensus after those difficult meetings Judge Earle described. We reached an agreement, but there were no high fives. There were no smiles. Everybody felt they got hurt. But as you know, as judges, if everybody in the courtroom is kind of upset with your decision, you probably got it right. Well, that's about where we were with this. We felt that we spread the pain appropriately and at a speed that was appropriate to what courts could absorb. But, so we've made what we think is a tough decision, but a good decision, and we highly recommend it to you as you make the tough decision about branch funding. Thank you.
That's right.
Tom Boris from Orange County. When I first joined this working group, I never imagined that every time under the formulas that we worked on, and ultimately this one that was decided upon, that Orange County would receive less of an allocation almost under every formula. And I want to say that it's time that we as a branch, we have to lower the drawbridges, fill in the moats that we put around our counties, and we have to start thinking of moving on from something we've done since 1994 with a funding process. And if it helps the judicial branch, Orange County believes in this formula. I agree with Judge Walsh. It's not perfect. There's a lot that still needs to be worked on. There's a lot that needs to be tweaked. But it is sound. It is fundamental. It's transparent. And it's defensible, not only to the other branches, but among ourselves as far as funding and revenue allocation. So I would urge the Judicial Council here to also support this allocation and revenue funding.
Justice Hull.
Thank you. I don't want to be premature in my questioning. I have to say that I've seen this presentation about six or seven times. And one cannot help but be impressed by the amount of work that's gone into it and the amount of compromise and the value of it. And we all appreciate that. The one question that comes to mind at the moment, perhaps for Judge Earle, because she spoke to this, the proposal anticipates that we would run this out over 5 years, at which point we'd be 50% workload allocation, 50% pro rata. Does that suggest that in year 6 and 7 and 8 it would remain at 50-50? And if that's the case, why do we not want to continue to work towards a fully implemented workload-based allocation?
I'm going to defer to Jake to address that.
So Justice, good. It's a great question. The reason for that is, again, what's on the screen now, the Part C and D, and that while we are saying within this model we can get us to 50-50, we can't take it all the way without new money. But as there's new money injected into the branch, as a reinvestment in the branch, we start to reduce the amount of money that's left in that historic base. So while it's 50-50, right, that base today, as you'll see in some of the spreadsheets, is about $1.4 billion. But as new money comes into the branch, that number decreases. And so that $1.4 billion becomes, there's $100 million more money, $1.3 billion, $1.2. And so the amount of money that is historically reallocated gets very small as new money comes in.
Well, I understand that, I think that's a very strong point in the recommendation. And I have to say that I've heard Mr. Chatters explain these things, and once again, it's very impressive. His abilities with statistics and mathematics and all are quite remarkable. But I do have a little trouble understanding why, whether we have what the amount of money we have now, or we have more money, or heaven forbid we have less money, why that money can't eventually be allocated fully on the trial court's workload measure.
I think the danger, Justice Hull, is that if we don't receive new money over the next 5 years, we have the scenario that I've described, which is we're really just shifting money from the underfunded courts to the severely underfunded courts, and thereby kind of they would be switching places with each other, and we would be before you again in 5 years saying, well, we tried, but because we went 100% on the model, now we have different courts who are below the average that we need to address. So it contemplates the fear or that if there's not any new money, that we would be harming ourselves in the long run.
Alan Carlson?
I think the other way to look at this is that's too narrow a view of what's going on here. That's just staying inside the branch. And I think this whole exercise has made it even more clear that we need to look wider. 5 years from now is an eternity in budget terms. I have no worry, and I don't think it's really important personally to say we'll be 50-50 in 5 years. Either in 5 years we're going to be way past 100% because we have new money and the formula got there much faster, or most of us won't be open anyway, so it doesn't make any difference. I think we need to focus on the next couple of years, and we need to focus on getting more money to the system, not how we beat each other up 5 years from now.
I agree with that.
And frankly, I think if we were to say we'll just take care of this all on our own, there's not much of incentive for the other branches to give us additional money if they see we can handle our problem ourselves. But handling the problem ourselves means adding to the disparity.
And Sherry and I were just whispering. She's going to show an example of that might help address that. The reason why getting there right now or getting to 100% may be a problem with no new money. So that will come in some of the charts later, I think, that might help.
So we have two other slides left that walks through the allocation process, and then Judge Walsh will talk about those issues that we identified that need to be considered in the model that we have not been able to finalize, and that will be our next phase of the work that we do.
Okay, so now let's fast forward. We have the Budget Act is complete. And we know how much we receive overall for the trial courts. And that's your first bubble here in Step A that says state trial court total allocation. Before the allocation decisions get made for our operating costs of the workload model, there are, again, those statewide expenses that are paid for essentially at a state level or through a different allocation method. So, again, court security, where the courts still pay for it. Dependency court-appointed counsel has its own allocation process. Jury, again, is a reimbursement interpreter. So, we need to take those out, right, because those have a separate allocation methodology. We also subtract out the costs associated with the subordinate judicial officers. And that gives us then what we've labeled here Z. There's no reason for it to be Z. It's just a letter we picked, which is the state trial court operations allocation. So that's the amount of money we have for our sort of core operational costs. So what our recommendation is and how that allocation works, this is just the graph, the picture version, is we take that number and multiply it by 90%, and then you multiply that by the court's historical funding percentage, which, for example, for my court is about 0.77% or 0.78% of the state trial court costs. And then we add to that same number times 10%, right? So that's the 10% factor, times what our share is of the new workload-based funding model, which is about 0.85 or 0.86%, so a higher percentage. Add back in our cost for subordinate judicial officers, and that then gives you what ultimately the council would be approving as our allocation for our sort of top-line operations allocation. And then we each obviously need to report and publish what our total cost or total budget is for the trial court. So in our Schedule 1s, right, that's our public document, we would then need to add in what we estimate our portions of those statewide costs are, either what has been approved as an allocation for court-appointed counsel or security, what our estimated jury costs are, et cetera. Add into that what are our local programs funded by local revenue, enhanced collections programs, and that then is what we would publish at the local court level as our Schedule 1 budget to make sure clearly that there is visibility into our total revenues and total expenses.
Commissioner Alexander?
I just have a question about the subordinate judicial officers. Is that based on the number that they're supposed to have eventually or the number they still have not yet been converted?
It is based on their current number of authorized SJOs. So if one is slated for conversion but has not converted, it would still be in that SJO number. Once it was converted, right. it would come out.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. But before I turn over my portion of the mic, I do want to just put a thank you out there. The subcommittee work has been rewarding, exciting, difficult at times, but we have received excellent support from AOC staff, from the Fiscal Services Unit with Stephen Chang and obviously Slatko Theodorovich, Jody Patel and her staff at trial court liaison offices, and then also court research, Dag McLeod's group, Leah Rose Goodwin, and Kristen Greenaway all have been very supportive. There were days where it was Friday and we're saying we need this updated and these spreadsheets updated by Monday. You'll see when Sherry walks you through them. They are very complicated spreadsheets with a lot of numbers, and they spend a lot of hours responding to our requests. So just a thank you to them. It's been, we couldn't have made through these very detailed work without their help.
All right. Next, I'm going to take a few moments to address what we've been calling the parking lot. Again, we know this is not perfect, and did not have enough time to address everything. So we've made a list of parking lot items. Currently, there are a little bit over 20. And every meeting we go to, people have suggestions. We write them down, so there'll be some more that will be added. Now, some of these are so arcane, only a CEO would love them, such as consider BLS deflators for Program 90 salaries separate from those for Program 10 salaries. All right, that's probably not keeping you awake at night. But some of them are more important and more basic, such as should filings be the sole basis for determining workload? So we've grouped these loosely into five categories. The first category is reevaluation of the effect of future changes in the judicial branch budget on this allocation method. So, for instance, what if in 1 year there's new money and the next year there's a cut? Are we back to the old one, or do you still stay at the same level of the allocation method? Or the last bullet point on that page, what if there's new money but it's one-time money or dedicated to a certain use? We're going to have to work out how that fits. We have not yet had a chance to do that yet. Next category is improvement and validation of the data to determine workload. So the first bullet point is not only to determine the accuracy of the data, but also consider factors other than filing, such as case complexity, also access to justice standards and best practices. We know the Justice Robies group, when they wrote into the funding group, stated, yes, we want a change. We want an allocation method that assures equal access, but defined it very differently than equal monies for equal filings. So to what extent should meeting Elkins factors or the DV report factors be a determinative? To what extent should outcomes be evaluated in this? And perhaps numbers of trials. The third item is grouping is the reevaluation of the role of salary and benefits. And the very first one on there is we do commit to reevaluating the effect on Cluster 1 courts. And we're going to do that by communicating with the Cluster 1 courts directly. We have had a representative of the Cluster 1 courts on our subcommittee. But we're going to reach out to them and to determine why did the model come out skewed. But I want to be clear. We're simply, in this role, bean counters. I mean, our job is to come up with an allocation method, not to set policy. We know that perhaps the economies of scale don't work real well in a Cluster 1 two-judge court. But this state has made a commitment to have 58 superior courts, two judges each. A courthouse is a symbol of what we stand for as a state, as a stand for, as a rule of law is the most important matter in a community. And we're not here to recommend, well, we somehow mush them together to make things more efficient. That's somebody else's call. I personally don't like the notion there's a courthouse in all 58 states and judges there to dispense justice. But it's not my call. We're just going to figure out how best to adapt the workload allocation method to those courts, and we're going to work closely with them to do it. Before I get to that, on that page, part of this grouping is also we're going to evaluate the salary component. There's been a lot of worry over whether or not the BLS factors are the appropriate way to go. But I want to assure everybody that while we're going to study that and we're going to study it thoroughly, The BLS factors, in terms of the total delta in our first year, 13-14, the total delta of losing courts and gaining courts, the BLS factors affect about only 10% of that. And since it's a 10% allocation in the first year, that means simply one penny on every funding dollar is affected by any tweaking of the BLS factors. It matters, but it's not skewing the whole result. But we will get to it, and we will get it right. Next grouping is an evaluation of the impact of outside factors on funding or expenses related to operations, such as how to consider technology funding. Where does that fit? If you spend money on it, if you get money for it, how does that fit? Is that part of this base or is it outside of that? And also extra staffing from multiple locations. How should that be weighed in? And then the fifth general grouping is the evaluation of the impacts of outside factors on funding or expenses unrelated to court operations. For instance, if you've got a courthouse and you as a local court are committed to paying a stream of money on it, or the branch is committed to paying it for you, should that come out of this allocation? Or, well, no, that's not strictly workload. It comes from a separate amount. We've not dealt with that. It's been discussed. One of the big issues we're going to deal with in this phase two is working out a unique factors protocol. But our hope is that by working hard on these items, we're going to reduce the number of unique factors. We don't want to create a situation where 58 courts come forward and say, well, I'm unique. To the extent we can address these properly, we'll have less demand for addressing unique factors. They will be addressed in future versions of this model. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So we'll walk you through the spreadsheets. Do we have those on there, Stephen?
Good morning. I'm Sherry Carter. I'm the Court Executive Officer from Riverside County. I think you have the handouts. I can refer them to their
book.
As you know, Riverside is a woefully underfunded court. As we walk through the spreadsheet so you can see how these changes impact courts, I'll use my county as an example as well as Orange County, an underfunded court. Before I go into the spreadsheets, I just want to remind you that they are being used to demonstrate the concepts or the methodology. The dollar amounts will change as we refine the cost of labor. If new data becomes available, these numbers will change. And so please don't look at the numbers as being gospel, because they're just really to reflect the methodology of the process. The first handout is on page A33. This chart reflects the amount each court will contribute to the $261 million ongoing reduction in FY13-14 based on the court's current pro rata share of the total base allocation. Again, we feel that it's important to use the current pro rata share because all of the courts have planned for that amount. Using Riverside as the first example, if you look at column 8, which is the last column on that page, our share of that is $10.5 million. That's how much will be reduced for us to contribute to that $261 million ongoing reduction. Orange County is $21.7 million. I think your charts are pretty hard to see, so you're going to have to trust me because I actually enlarge my charts and can read the numbers. But that's the first chart. If you turn to page A34, the purpose of this chart is to reflect the state funding allocation estimated for each court based on the current pro rata method, including the $261 million ongoing reduction. So this is the current pro rata share, and if you go all the way to the last column 11, after the adjustments, if we continued with the pro rata share, Riverside County, we get about $57.3 million. And Orange County would get about $122.3 million. I'm going to refer you back to these numbers in other charts, so remember that this is the pro rata share under the existing formula. The next chart is actually quite complicated because it incorporates a lot of different thoughts throughout the chart, so I'm going to refer you to a couple of columns. The first one is... Yeah, sorry, it starts on page A35, okay? the first column that you should refer to is column C. This is the estimated FTE need based on RAS. If you look at Riverside County, it shows that we should have 1,232 FTEs for the money for that, because remember, you can't really tie the number of employees to this number. What it does is it becomes a lump sum, and then each county determines how best to meet those statutory duties and responsibilities. I can give you a very good example if you're interested, but I think we've already gone through that process. Orange is 1,493 FTEs that will then be converted into a lump sum. The next important column is the estimated need for salary based on RAS and the actual average salaries in each county as reported by the courts in their mandatory Schedule A reports. And that's important to understand because this is what the courts have indicated that they are currently paying. So we didn't use an average salary for the state. It's the average salary within each county. And that is column H. That converts the FTE to a dollar amount. For Riverside, it would be $66.5 million. I'm rounding slightly, as you can see. And for Orange, it would be $102.5 million. The next important column is column J, because that is the estimated cost of labor after the cost of labor adjustment has been put in place. And again, these are just to demonstrate the methodology. These numbers are not going to be exact. But as you can see for Riverside, because according to this draft model, Riverside is 9% below, that would increase my salary amount. And in Orange County, because based on this draft, again, they're 6% above, it would reduce their salary. And that's how the cost of labor adjustment would work in theory. If you now turn to page 2, which are the following page, we're going to talk about benefits. This is, you're right, 836. Chart. So this would be column O. That is applying the cost of benefits after adjustments for the salary-driven benefits, like retirement, and using the actual non-salary-driven benefits as reported by the individual counties on their mandatory Schedule 7As. The next column, P, is for operating expenses and equipment per FTE based on actual spending. As Jake indicated, a subcommittee of this subcommittee went through every single line item for the courts to decide what should be included, what should be excluded, and this is based on actuals. And as Jake also indicated, you can see at the bottom of your chart the amount paid per FTE for the 15 Cluster 1 courts is at almost $28,000 per FTE, whereas for the rest of the courts, it's closer to $20,000 per FTE because of those fixed costs that we identified. The next important column that you will see is column R, which reflects the estimated funding need for salaries, benefits, and OE&E as a total. If you look at Riverside, it would be $129.5, I'm rounding again, million. For Orange County, it would be $172.3 million. And then the next column, S, creates a new percentage of for each county of the total from R. Remember Jake said that his percentage change under the new model? So does Riverside and so does Orange. And you can see that when you compare R and S to the next two columns, T and U. Remember I told you to remember the numbers from the first spreadsheet? If you look at T for Riverside, you'll see that $57.3 million. That's under the current pro rata model with my current percentage next to that. Go back over to R, and you'll see that if we were fully funded under the new model, we would go to $129.5 million. Orange County would go from $122.3 million to $172.3 million, and their percentages would fall where Riverside's would increase. If you now turn the page, you'll see that some of those columns have just been carried over for easy reference. The first column, again, is the total estimated need for staff, benefits, and OE&E. The next column is the current pro rata share. The next column is the new allocation methodology implemented at 100%. And again, I'd like to refer you to Riverside and Orange County. This means that under the pro rata share, which is T, Riverside would jump from $57.3 million to $76 million. Orange would go from $122.3 million to $101 million.
That's 100% under the new model.
That's under 100% of the new model, as I mentioned. And that's why we unanimously felt that we needed to have a phased-in approach, because even as a woefully underfunded county, I believe that that's too drastic to do. And our recommended approach are the next five columns that will reflect how the new funding methodology will impact each county. Again, draft, the numbers aren't to be relied on at 100%, but if you follow Riverside, if you compare T, which is our current pro rata share, to W, which would be the 1090 approach for next year, we will jump from $57.3 million to $59.1 million, and Orange will go from $122.3 million to $120.1 million. And then you can follow on for the next 5 years how that approach, how the phased-in approach would work. The next spreadsheet actually does the math for you. It makes it a little easier for you to follow because it summarizes the impact on each county by just looking really at the last column. Again, these are draft numbers, but if you look at Riverside, we would get about $1.8 million, and Orange County would lose about $2.1 million. What's important at this point for me is to have you go back to the first chart we covered. And the reason I say that, and that's on A33, is because we are just reallocating existing money. And I think that's an important part, because the $1.8 million to Riverside just means that the amount of my contribution to the $261 million goes down slightly. And it means to Orange that their almost $22 million contribution to the $261 million just got increased by two more million. Because we're just reallocating new money. And I think that's important to remember.
Existing money.
I think that's an important point, because it's not going to be the full solution. The last chart is my favorite chart, because this shows the effect of a theoretical $100 million of new money and how that theoretically would be spread. The bottom line to the chart is really the second to the last column. I'll be happy to walk you through, but you've already heard how it works. We would get $100 million of new money. We would take $100 million of existing money. We would reallocate $200 million under the new formula, and the result or the impact is the second to the last column. So if you look at Riverside, we would get $6.4 million, and Orange County would get $5.5 million. And that's how that would work. If you have specific questions on any of the columns, I'd be happy to answer them, but I think I pointed out the columns that were most important.
Alan Carlson?
I want to make a point that maybe is misunderstood. The historical allocation formula actually cuts both ways. When we're going up getting new money, if you were underfunded and had a lower percentage, you don't get a percentage as much. But when you go the other direction and cut money, which we've been doing for the last several years, those courts that were historically underfunded are actually advantaged by the use of the historical formula. So, for example, Orange County, if we use the new formula instead of the old formula, our cut would be reduced $1.9 million, almost $2 million. And San Joaquin, by comparison, if we use the new number instead of the old number, because their percentage goes up, their cut would be increased by $1.3 million. So the cuts actually have helped the lesser funded courts over the last several years. It's not helped anybody very much, but it's not as bad as it sounded. It's made to sound.
Sounds bad.
The poor are poorer.
Judge Rosenberg.
I don't know, Judge Earle, if you're finished with your presentation, I wanted to make a quick comment.
I think that concludes our presentation.
Judge Rosenberg, Judge So, Commissioner Alexander, Judge Jacobson, remember your order, Judge Jackson, Judge Ellsworth, and then Justice Miller.
I can remember where I am in that order. Three quick observations. Number one, when we look back on that 1997 historical model, when the courts went from a county-funded system of 58 counties to a state-funded system, it essentially never changed in those years. A little tweak here and there for a year or two, but it never changed. And it didn't change in 1997 because it was politically too difficult mm-hmm. to do that. They accomplished a lot in 97 with the Trial Court Funding Act, but that's one thing they couldn't accomplish. Mm-hmm. And here we are a lot of years later, and I think we're accomplishing at least the start of the change. Number two, your new model essentially is based on workload. That's the bottom line, the core of the new model. And as I've looked at this across the country, that seems to be the fairest basis for a new model. That seems to be what other jurisdictions are looking at and doing, and I commend you for going to a workload-based model. And finally, I would just say the concept, as you called it, Judge Earle, of a glide path is a compromise. In my view, it's Solomonic because there's no perfect solution to fixing this overnight. And so a glide path is necessary. I just really want to commend Judge Earle and all the members of this working group for rolling up their sleeves and just getting down into the mud of this issue and coming up with a much better formula. The old saying is, the perfect is the enemy of the good. This is good. And I appreciate the so-called parking lot issues where you're going to continue to tweak as you learn more.
Okay. Go ahead, Judge Sutton.
Judge Walsh, Judge Boris, Sherry, Jake, under the able leadership of Judge Earle, you are really to be congratulated. This has been a lot of work. It's been very, very difficult. And what you've done for the branch really is monumental, and I hope you all realize that. Additionally, I'd like to congratulate Jody, and in particular, I want to embarrass DAG. So, DAG, you're in the audience. Please stand up. Mm-hmm. I want everybody to know who you are. Because DAG for 5 years has been working on this. And so now everybody knows why the California Judicial Branch will allocate money the best way possible.
Thank you. And Judge Herman, you'll be after Judge Ellsworth. Commissioner Alexander?
On the five-year plan, I'm trying to figure out the interrelationship between the work, the SB 56 group, and so if there's an ongoing workload look and it changes during the next 5 years, is there an anticipation of how that interplays with this?
We will be, the numbers that RAS is based on, the column C on page 835,
right,
will be adjusted every year. It's on a
three-year
average.
Okay.
So those numbers will adjust every year, which is a good thing because that way if there's a spike or a fall, it'll be evened out.
And then those would be, I mean, these, I know these are draft numbers,
right,
and so
right,
so that new number would go into the formula,
exactly,
and then the 10 or 20 or 30% would then be allocated.
Exactly.
And I'm not trying to jump ahead of anybody, but as you can imagine, I have a motion, I think, that incorporates
that's
all
that.
Of
that.
And then seven-part motion. To further clarify that, too, there's other elements that will change our workload. So AB 109 and criminal justice realignment is the best example now, that came about as new workload for us after the work of the SB 56 working group had done their data collection. And so as it stands now, you'll see it as a separate allocation. But obviously, as years go by, we're contemplating that underlying weighted caseload model will get updated. Not every year, it's too complicated a task, but that will get updated and incorporate some of those new workload items or as things change so that we don't just sit stagnant for 50 years about how it works today.
So the bubble that has the unique funding will disappear from there as things are measured and fall into the RAS piece.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Judge McCabe after Judge Herman.
Chief, I have a question and a comment. I'd like to start with a question. And I pray this does not come to pass, but suppose the governor and the Department of Finance and the legislature in their wisdom cut us further. Does your model respond to lower baseline funding than what we have now? Suppose that instead of giving us $100 million, they take another $100 million. How does the model respond to that?
Well, okay. The answer is it does not.
It does not.
Okay.
It does not. Look, dear governor, dear legislature, you said to us, unless you come up with a new allocation method, we will not give you new funding. We have come up with a new allocation method, the best allocation method in the country. Don't even think about going
okay
the other way. There's no plan for it. It's all bets are off. We're going to go back in a huddle. This is only aimed at current funding or new funding.
Thank you very much. I have 2 points that I need to make. I'm from Morris Jacobson from Alameda County, and we're one of the donor courts. On behalf of my court, I need to express a general feeling of nervousness about the unique factor analysis that's currently in the parking lot and how that'll play out and to what degree that analysis ultimately from year to year will be subjective and vary depending on the makeup of the work group. I have to say personally that I'm deeply impressed by the fact that a number of members here before us today in this work group are from donor courts and are putting their own personal needs aside for the good of the branch. And I personally have great faith in the people that will be carrying out these duties in the future. The second point that I wish to make is, and to echo what several of the speakers have said, is that we're all hurting. It seems to me that we are all, so to speak, either at the poverty line or well below it. My court is a donor court. And I would point out that over the last 4 years, we've had two rounds of layoffs. We've laid off 100 people. We haven't just been doing it by attrition. Our staffing is down about 30%. We have reduced clerk office hours. We're struggling to do very basic things such as get restraining orders that have been either permanently or temporarily issued. We struggle to get those in on time because we don't have staff and we don't have money for overtime. When I think about some of the other donor courts, Fresno and what we've been hearing about Fresno and the closure of courts, that's a donor court? That's one of our better courts? And that's just shocking to me. Mendocino County, Judge Hardcastle gave us a very eloquent description of the situation in Mendocino County at our last meeting. That's a donor court. So I understand that the donor courts are hurting not quite as much as the receiving courts. I fear a state where all of our courts will be below the poverty line. I would like to push today for this reallocation to only apply to new funding. I recognize that the method here answers that question in a very persuasive way in my mind. And so my ultimate comment is I'm strongly in favor of adopting this model because it moves us towards equitable funding, which we have a responsibility as a branch to take care of all 58 courts. I beseech the governor, the legislature, and the Department of Finance to restore our funding. That's my comment, Chief.
Thank you, Judge Jacobs. Judge Jackson?
Just briefly, first I want to thank this group. Not only did they do the presentation throughout the state, but they also responded to questions individually on the phone, went through, and I really do appreciate it, and I'm sure if I have further questions, you'll take my calls. But more importantly, I appreciate, too, the fact that I was concerned about the BLS and specificity and how if those numbers and for that matter, all the numbers that are being used in this methodology, that you are continuing to look at that. In fact, we're going to have a report back, I believe, Judge Earl, you said in July. And I really do appreciate it. I don't look at us as donors or the recipient courts. I look at us as all courts. We're all one. And we're here to help each other. And that's why I very much appreciate the methodology. I support the methodology. And that the committee and the hard work that you've done and the continued work that you will be doing.
Thank you, Judge Jackson. Judge Ellsworth.
Thank you, Chief. I want to specifically thank Judge Earl for this phenomenal work that she's done. I think she deserves a round of applause. I think that her whole group has done something extraordinary, and I think that when this is done, we are going to see something yet again in this Judicial Council room convened by our Chief as historic to the branch. We were given a charge that said, either do something or we will do it for you. And we decided not to let it be done for us, but we stood up as a third branch of government. And we took on this challenge. Not only did we take on this challenge, we took it on with the best and the brightest that you convened together. The individuals that shared this group that you chaired, including staff, and CEOs and judges up and down the state are nothing short of phenomenal. I know for a fact it was on their time and on their dime, so to speak. And they met on the phone. They met in person. They met long. They met hard. They wrestled. They rolled up their sleeves. They did everything that we asked of them, and yet more. They did it on their own. I have to tell you, and I've said it individually, and I will say it again, Judge Walsh, Judge Boris, and Judge Trinacosta at the Trial Court Budget Working Group, they are heroes in my estimation. They stood up and said in a room full of individuals that we are going to get hit and we have to give up certain things. But we are willing to do that because we are the third branch of government. And until we establish or reestablish ourselves loud and firm that by saying that we will give, that we will work this out, it just wasn't going to occur. To think that in some way that this report or this recommendation is now before us and we just assemble along and rubber stamp things is really a statement of the highest order of ridiculous. They have worked on this. They have vetted it individually with courts, regionally with courts. And I was at that trial court budget working group, and that was no picnic, quite frankly. And the way that the conversation went was a grappling again, a debate, a strong debate, a wrestling. And at the end, to think that the judges in that group, representative of small courts, large courts, medium courts, courts that will be giving out of their pockets, so to speak. I love your analogy, Judge Walsh, of all of us kind of in the soup kitchen line, and somebody is sharing a quarter of it they really don't have. At the end, they voted unanimously, save one abstention. I never thought we would get there. I didn't think that certain judges and I would vote the same way when I looked across the room after our robust debate. But under the leadership of Judge Earl and this ABLE committee, we come now, and I know you called shotgun, so I'm going to defer to you, Miller, but if I were making a motion, which I won't because you've done that, I certainly would embrace this recommendation in its fullest presentation. And I think there are two critical things, Chief, that I would urge this Judicial Council to do. One being that we have to have these same leaders work on this same group to help take us through these next waves. If we were to disband the subcommittee as convened by Judge Earle and possibly even and probably even the trial court working group that's now an advisory group and infuse it solely with new folks, we might be starting all over again. And I don't want to lose that traction. And the other thing is, if I were making a motion, which I am not, I would urge that motion to embrace this, the entire five-year plan, the entire plan, not to, I think that Judge Earle said it best when she said, we have to show a sincere vetting, we have to be a strong voice, we're invested in this, we have a process we've created, and we have stood up as Judge Walsh and Judge Boris and said, you asked us to do this because if we don't, you were going to intervene. Quit intervening and start putting back the money now. So those are my comments and my illusions to what I would do if I were Justice Miller.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Ellsworth. We'll hear from Judge Herman, Judge McCabe, Justice Hull, and then Mary Beth Todd.
I'm not sure when Lori Earle sleeps. When do you sleep? I just I'm on committees with Sherry Carter and with Jake Chatters. I don't know when you sleep. I don't know when Judge Boris and Judge Walsh sleep. I'm one of the underfunded as opposed to woefully underfunded courts, and I just want to acknowledge marvelous images from Judge Walsh about he's not that heavy. He's my brother. And Judge Boris about the need for us as 58 trial courts to pull up our drawbridges and fill in our moats and just realize that, you know, there are big issues out there that I'm amazed that we can sit around and come to a conclusion and an agreement that probably could not have been forced upon us. And luckily we avoided it being forced upon us from one of the other branches. So I'm just unbelievably grateful to you. Thank you.
Judge McCabe.
Thank you. Brian McCabe from Merced. It's been a distinct honor to work on this committee. This truly is a collection of some very unique, talented, energetic individuals. And so it's my distinct pleasure to be sitting in the same room with these folks trying to contribute when you have so much talent in there. I think a second thanks goes out again to AOC staff. They have really gone above and beyond, and we have pushed them very hard, and they have produced. And at times it reminds me of the 1970s Oakland A's baseball team. You know, we're at each other internally, but externally. We have the face of professionalism and camaraderie, and we get the job done. And they were champions, and I think this group are champions. I'm really proud of them, and the AOC staff have really done a great job. Another shout-out, which hasn't really been stated fully, is we really owe a thanks to the SB 56 working group and its chair, Judge Oxney. They have a five-year model that allowed us to come up to speed so fast. Without it, quite frankly, it would not have been possible. And so it is invaluable data, which will be built on because of AB 109, et cetera. But again, it was critically important. So I'm very, very thankful and mindful that we stand on their shoulders in such a short time. And so thank you, Judge Oxney and that group. The state wide methodology affects trial courts individually, and it creates relative parity, something that I think was intended by the 1997 Trial Court Act. The the methodology we have here not only looks at individual trial courts and what it views as needed for them to operate, but then collectively what it would take. And so when we did this analysis, it was $1.4 billion for the trial courts is what we're currently under. We need another $2.4 billion for them to work, plus there's about $700 million in reimbursables. So the total's 3.1. But the funding, the $1 billion, it's apparent when you look through the numbers, if you like numbers or you don't like numbers, as you go through each of these, it's painfully clear that there is a problem for each and every court to properly operate as intended. Now, governor's office and legislature are probably listening. I hope I'm politically adept. I'm being diplomatic. I note that it's all about priorities. A budget is a statement of priorities. And a penny on the dollar isn't cutting it, and I understand we're doing our part. However, three branches of government, the three branches are so essential to the orderly operation of a society, they cannot be ignored. That's the first place you start. When you're on an airplane and the stewardess tells you, in the event that there's loss of air, put the oxygen mask on yourself, not the child or the other person first. Why? Because it's essential that you have the oxygen first before you can help others. This is a cry out to the legislature and the governor. We've heard and taken your warnings. We hopefully believe that the methodology that we are presenting to you meets your expectations. And so you've nudged us where we probably didn't want to go, but we've gone there. And we're proud of this product. And we're hopeful that now that we have done this, that the legislature and the governor's office will now begin to reinvest in the third branch, its sister branch of government. And I mean no offense by that, and I hope it's not intended as offensive. There's underfunded and severely underfunded courts. Under this methodology, the severely underfunded will receive a benefit, and the issue then shifts to the, not from the viability of the new budget methodology, to the implementation time. That really seems to be a focus right now. That was contentious. There is, and that's an understatement. And we are all mindful of this. However, we are all, as we sat in the room and it was dawning on us what the effects would be and how this would affect us individually, we came to the collective that my honorable friend from Alameda, Judge Jacobson, noted, is that this is a statewide approach, and we can't look at this at any one court. And as I think Ben Franklin most ably said, we must hang together or else we shall most assuredly hang separately. We're in this together, folks. And we have to act as a unit. Divisiveness has been damaging to this industry. And I think this is a model that will help bring us together, even though it's going to hurt some. My friends on the committee from Orange County, from Santa Clara County, from Sacramento County, from these other counties that are going to be hurt by this, I tip my hat to you. Because it's not about you. It's about the state, the branch. And to me, I think that's the appropriate focus. So as heartfelt as I can tell you, I'm urging you to adopt this. I will note that the timing of this is not unique, the phase-in. And I think I shared this at some of the regional meetings. The education system dealt with this in the early 2000s. AB 441, 2001. the Fairness in Education Funding Act. Does it sound familiar? They went through the same growth pains, same struggle that we're dealing with now. And what did they do? Did what others have done, phased it in. And they did it over a seven-year period. I think we all recognize the damage that can be done by a 100% implementation. And that's not to minimize my friends in San Joaquin County, because Merced, Stanislaus, a number of us in the Inland Empire and San Joaquin Valley are all in that severely underfunded boat. And I hear you. I feel your pain. On the other hand, I think the prudent way, the unified way, is to deal this on a global view, and that view is we need to take this a step at a time. So with that, I would urge you to adopt each of the recommendations. Thank you, Chief.
Justice Holt.
Thank you, Chief. I, of course, join in the congratulatory comments and the other comments made by my colleagues on the council, and I don't want to necessarily go back to the unthinkable, but following up on the answer to Judge Jacobson's question regarding, as I say, you hate to even use the word, further cuts, and recognizing in myself that I have learned just enough about this process to be dangerous, I don't quite understand conceptually, simply conceptually, why this funding methodology would not be equally applicable to less money coming into the branch. And the reason I say that is Judge Walsh's question, or Judge Walsh's answer, was entirely correct. And I suspect we probably would have to go back to the drawing board, so to speak, at that point. But I did not want to leave any suggestion, and because none of us are making this suggestion, that if there are further cuts, that we are going to scrap this valiant effort and just go back to business as usual. I don't think that's anybody's intention, and I'll leave it at that.
Mary Beth Todd.
Thank you, Chief. I, too, want to thank the working group. I was an invited guest to sit in on several of the subcommittee, the funding methodology working group meetings, and I started as saying I was an observer, but I didn't just observe for very long, did I, Judge? So I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to participate and provide some input. I totally support the methodology and certainly recognize and appreciate all of the diverse opinions and positions that went into the process and ended with the methodology that's being presented today. I wanted to take the opportunity, though, to just emphasize a few things. Certainly over the last several weeks, I've been approached by different courts, different colleagues who've expressed concerns, expressed support, both, and just wanted to note a few different items that we've had some discussions on, and to just emphasize my knowledge that this is not a finished product, that this is a work in progress, that the parking lot isn't the parking lot we're used to seeing when we go to different conferences and it sort of sits there, and then once we leave the conference, it goes away. I know it is a working document that the working group will be taking forward and continue to evolve the methodology. The few things I wanted to talk about were the fact that, and I think Judge McCabe, there we go, just alluded to it, is that when you looked at how much funding we need and how much funding there is to allocate, we were right around the 69 to 70% mark, and I don't even know if that included the 261 million reductions. So that means that if we totally leveled the playing field, we'd all be at about, all the courts would be at about 70% funding. That would be intolerable. There are courts that are below 50%. That is intolerable. I kind of liken it to the prisoners in the yard, and they all band together to help some at least get over the wall. We're not going to all get over the wall, But as long as there are some of us over on that other side, it will only help to get the rest of us over at a later date. And I think to take some of the, if we were to level the playing field immediately, those courts that have been able to hang on to some resources and do some innovative projects and continue to at least move forward the concepts of access to justice, efficiency, we want to hang on to those things for as long as we can. And hopefully what will happen is we won't have to strip them bare. We won't have to ask the question or grapple with the fact, what do we do if there is no new money and there are more cuts? That's the only way we're going to continue to move this branch forward and address the many issues that our previous presentation from the trial court funding statewide working group and their recommendations to ensure that we move forward with a methodology that will improve access to justice. And I think that this does this. I think that the five-year plan helps us do that without sacrificing all of the innovation that we need to be able to move all of those programs forward so that when we do restore some funding, we can all benefit for those who have gone before us and start to implement the proven technologies and the proven concepts that those courts are able to do. With respect to the $261 million reduction, I just wanted to emphasize that in addition to the fact that the reason why we have all planned for it, I want to just clarify that. I don't think that the concept is that, oh, we planned for it, we're going to take our hits anyway, because there are courts out there that we've heard from that have planned for it, but it's catastrophic. Those reductions already have been allocated to us. It's just that over the last couple of years, we've seen some offsets to those reductions. And so that was why the $261 million, it was determined we would leave it at the pro rata. They were already allocated pro rata, and then we had seen some offsets. And now with the depletion of the offsets, we're going to be experiencing the full impact of those reductions. The other issue I wanted to talk about were the unique factors. I want to manage expectations here. As you heard in the presentation, the number of unique factors to be considered are very, we're trying to keep the pool as small as possible, because as one court makes that pitch for the unique factor and it's approved, until we have new money, it just serves to bring other courts down. And we've got to be very careful that we manage that process and don't get too crazy with it. Especially as we start to see the larger courts, they will have unique factors. And as we start to fund that, when we start to get to the lower end of the smaller courts, they feel those fluctuations greatly. And so I just wanted to add that caveat that we are going to have to tread very carefully with the unique factors. The last thing I wanted to talk about was the small court, the cluster ones. And I just wanted to say that we have heard the concerns because in the model it would appear that they are not as under-resourced. We all know that that is not the case, and that is why the decision was made to not apply the model to them for this first year, because we know many of those are really under-resourced. They're feeling it. It's in the model, and what it takes to open your doors. There is a base amount that every court needs to keep, you know, open to the public. And we've got to get our arms around what that amount is and what the appropriate formula is for those small courts. And I just want to emphasize that I do know that that is first and foremost with the working group. That is a parking lot issue that I know Judge Earl has been talking with me and with others on getting some small courts together to continue to work on that issue, that it will not be lost, there's no concept that somehow small courts are over-resourced or not as poorly resourced. We recognize that it's a matter with the methodology, and that will be continue to be looked at. So those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Before I turn this over to Justice Miller for one of his motions, I want to also concur in all the laudatory comments of all the work you've done. I know that you've worked long and hard in a short period of time. I commend you, Presiding Judge Earl, for bringing together the group and working through difficult questions and answers, and the AOC's support in this. And when I think not only of the work product you've produced and that it is the way to go forward, I think also that, as importantly, you really shifted the paradigm. This group of CEOs and presiding judges have really worked with your fellow presiding judges to talk about each other's needs, to know where you are in the continuum of woe. And for me, I hope that's a new dialogue for the branch as we go forward with other difficult issues, and you've really set the shining example of that, this ability to work through an otherwise insurmountable problem 16 years ago that you brought and pulled everyone over across the finish line in a matter of months. I know it sounds easier than it was, I know, but I cannot begin to express the gratitude I have for the work all of you have done. And walking us through these charts, you made it sound so simple. Sherry is looking at these charts with these numbers, and we appreciate that, that you are able to explain this throughout the state. Everyone feels as a result of your magnanimous act that we understand it and that we're along and it's a start and it's not perfect. But really, from on behalf of the branch, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chief. Can I just, before Justice Miller takes over, just say that we appreciate the compliments and the recognition. I would have to say, though, that the real heroes here are Dag and Stephen Chang and Leah and the CEOs who put their hard work. And I hope I don't offend my judicial colleagues, but our CEOs are really, really smart. And they spent a lot of time working on this at their own court expense. And I will have to say that I felt at times that Jody and I were like conductors. And we would be in there saying, this is what you have to do. And then I would get a daily phone call from Justice Miller saying, how you doing? And then I would get one from Justice Hull. And then I'd get some from you, Chief. And so we traded our conductor wands, as Stephen Nash says, for whips. And we really did kind of drive these people. And sometimes I think as the anxiety built, Jody and I tried not to use the whips on each other as I was pushing her and she was pushing her staff. So we did, I think, the best thing about this is that we worked collectively and collaboratively to bring this to you. So thank you.
Thank you. Justice Miller.
Thank you. So I too, want to start with praising each of you and each of your committee members and the AOC staff that worked with you. And I want to tell you that for me personally, I wasn't there, but as you said, we talked on a regular basis and struggled through all this. And I am especially proud today as a Judicial Council member to be a part of this, because this is historic, and you really all should be proud of that. And then to echo a little of what the Chief said, you all should be very proud of what you accomplished, because it shows what we do so well as a judicial branch. We work through the deliberative process. We hear opposing views. And then working together, what we can accomplish. And you should be commended for this, because it wasn't easy. It wasn't without differing and strong voices in that process. But again, it shows what we can do and what we can accomplish so much better when we work together. So you really, really should be proud of that. And we didn't give you the applause that was recommended by the motion that was made by Judge Ellsworth. So I thank you all. So I have one motion, and it's long, so here goes. This is my motion, to accept this report and adopt its proposed workload-based allocation and funding methodology and the five-year implementation timeline, as is set forth on page 2 and 3 of your report, where it's listed 1, 2, and 3, A through D, with the understanding that there is further refining that needs to be done with regards to the cost of labor adjustments, and that would be a report back to the Judicial Council in June, and that my motion would be that is assigned to your current group under the leadership of Judge Earl. Also, that the Council maintains its authority to manage the budget of the branch and to make modifications to the methodology and timeline as appropriate in each of the budget years in the future. Second part, on page 8 of your report to the council, it lays out 8 items that need further consideration for potentially incorporating into the allocation and funding methodology. Those are the parking lot items. They were listed on the slides today as items 1 through 5. They were titled a little bit differently than as on your report on page 8, but I think that my motion incorporates every one of them. And again, my intent is to make sure that they are all assigned someplace and that they are all taken care of in the future from today. So the first, evaluate impacts of the new methodology on California's smallest courts, Cluster 1, and include or make adjustments as appropriate. And my motion is to refer that to the new Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee. Further refine the process for estimating employee benefits. Again, my motion is that that be referred to the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee. Evaluate self-help funding. My motion is that that be referred to the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee. Also, though, to work in conjunction with Access and Fairness and the new committee that will be created in that regards. Evaluate the impact of AOC-provided services. My motion is to refer that to Executive in Planning to review and to report back to the council. The next part is to include best practice standards. And, again, that was an item that was in the previous motion under item O, and my motion is to refer that to E&P for the creation of a new committee, which will review that and report back to the council. Evaluate what to do with local fees and financial obligations, to refer that to the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee. Evaluate how to allocate funding for technology, similar to what was in item O. That's to be referred to the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee in conjunction with the Technology Committee. Validate the data used in the new methodology, including the accuracy of the data, and that is also to part of my motion to refer that to the SB 56 Advisory Committee. And it's assumed within my motion that with regards to these parking lot items that are assigned to the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee, that we will work executive and planning in conjunction with the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee through their chair, Judge Earle, to make sure that your current committee members are included in the various aspects of this, but that we will work together to create the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee and their subcommittees in a way that makes sure that we take into consideration the staffing needs. So the last part of my motion is again, to direct the administrative director of the courts to work with E&P to assess and report back to the council in June on resources required to provide necessary and appropriate levels of staff support to implement the workload-based allocation and funding methodology as set forth in this motion.
To Judge Rosenberg, then Judge Ellsworth.
I would second that motion, and I would respectfully request a roll call, since
Understood.
This is a very historic event.
Thank you, Judge Rosenberg. Judge Ellsworth.
I have a question and a concern. I know that in part of your motion, you incorporated language like we'll work together with the current subcommittee. But I want to make sure that in your motion, it includes that anything that is farmed out, much like when the SEC report was adopted by the council, that actually you have the members of the subcommittee is now constituted, or a sub of that, if that's a little unwieldy, to actually sit in on those, any meetings that have to do with the discussion and dialogue with regard to this, and be a part advisory to EMP. I think that way we are not reinventing the hard work that they have. They're the experts, and it's worked wonderfully with the SEC. So if that is something you contemplate or that you would consider to incorporate as a friendly amendment, then I could stand behind your motion and be counted as well to support it.
So the first part of my motion is to keep their group exactly intact as it is to deal with the cost of labor issue that they're going to report back in June. The second part of my motion is to create the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee and its subgroups, and then also E&P is going to create a new committee to deal with some of the parking lot issues. So I want to make sure that these members are spread out all over the place, and so I'm not making as part of my motion that they be created as a subcommittee in perpetuity. I'm saying for that one aspect, yes. On the other part, E&P will work with the chair of the trial court budget advisory group to make sure that they are in this process somewhere.
I just don't understand that in this process somewhere. So to me, if it's on those, the five, the parking lot is what I'm really, the concern is. And I'm not suggesting you make it into perpetuity, but my thought is that at least the language of your motion, at least I'm not hearing it, is that at a minimum, a few of these folks are on that, are involved and put on the actual committee as advisory, much like the SEC is the only thing I can say. And I know
I don't think they're going to escape. I think they're going to be a part of this.
I appreciate that.
I just didn't want to create it as a standing subcommittee of the trial court budget working group.
Yeah, I understand that.
Judge Earl?
So following up on that, I think the question that I have, Justice Miller, about your motion, for instance, one of the items on our parking lot list was evaluate the impact of AOC-provided services. Really, we had a 10-minute discussion about this and recognized that we didn't need to have to deal with that as we go into fiscal year 13-14.
Right.
It was a discussion that we'll have in the future. How would you envision the trial court budget advisory committee working with EMP on that particular issue?
It'll be referred to E&P, and then they'll make assignments to the different groups where that should go based on whatever those needs may be. So it may go to technology. It may go to some other committee. It may go to the trial court budget working group.
But would you envision that we would have that conversation within our group and then communicate with E&P on what our suggestions are?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Judge Kaufman.
You know, I haven't said anything, and I'm just listening. And on the one hand, you're asking the Cluster 1 courts to trust you and giving us a seat at the table. And that's fine, and I'm willing to do that. And we've had discussions, and I really appreciate everything everybody said. I appreciate you're willing to have many of us sit at the table and discuss this further. But there has to be trust on both sides. If we're going to work as a branch and get to where we need to go, we have to trust the Judicial Council and everybody that we'll make this happen, that we'll make it work. We can't have this dissension, because if we have it now, it's not going to get anywhere. So I trust Justice Miller, and I trust Judge Earl to work together to form a committee of committees and with the chief, and we'll get there. It's historic. Let's not stop. Let's keep going.
Judge Stone.
And I think what we're really doing is we're trusting the chief to staff the advisory committees in a way that will be fair to courts of all sizes. And I think that she has consistently shown that she's included groups, people of differing opinions, and I think we can see in the future that will continue.
Judge Jacobson, Alan Carlson.
Just very briefly, I will not be on the roll call for a vote. If I had a vote, I would support Justice Miller's motion in full.
Thank you. Judge Alan Carlson.
Alan Carlson, Orange County. Being on the subgroups, whatever, I'm not sure that – I think there's two pieces to the issue about the AOC staff. I think what I hear from you is you're concerned about you're responsible for the AOC staff and what they do, and that's definitely a legitimate piece of this. But I think a lot of our concern was there are services provided to trial courts, which they do not pay for because they're provided by the AOC. Nobody has a problem with that, except it's not fair if some other court has to pay for that service if you're talking about an allocation formula. And I think that's part of where our group was coming from was I agree to totally the council's obligation to decide what services the AOC provides. But our concern was also who gets credit for that or not credit for that in terms of allocation of funding. So that it's a slightly different aspect than I think you're thinking of when you say E&P is going to be in charge of this.
So could I take that as a friendly amendment, then, that with regards to that, evaluate the impact of AOC-provided services, that it be assigned jointly to E&P and the trial court budget advisory group? I get mixed up on my own terms I came up with, the trial court budget advisory committee, to work in conjunction on that and make appropriate assignments.
And I want to say, rest assured, the Judicial Council in the last 2.5 years I believe, is undertaking major steps at certain restructuring. And I have no interest in bringing in new people to start over to explain this. So I view this as there are subject matter experts on this now, and it benefits us, just like SEC subject matter experts. And so what I'm saying is there may be a time when all of you are going to have to hang together with us for a few more years until we get through this. And then when we get through some of these major directives, you'll see us having more openings on advisory committees and council because we've gotten over some of our major directives. But I don't expect anyone will be leaving anytime soon on some of these important issues for the branch.
And I second that, and that's what I was saying to you.
Well, I'm comforted then. Okay, when it comes from the chief, it just sounds so much more comforting.
I would accept that friendly amendment and simply say, you guys just hit a grand slam home run once we take this vote. We're not going to trade you away.
Maybe they will.
Take the vote.
Okay, so I think we've had a discussion, the motion, the friendly amendment, the second. We're going to do a roll call vote. I'll ask Judge Jarre to participate to lead that.
All right, then. Roll call alphabetical order. Signify your vote. Justice Ashman Gerst.
Yes.
Judge Baker.
Yes.
Justice Baxter.
Yes.
Judge Brandlin.
Yes.
Ms. Davis.
Yes.
Judge DeAlba.
Yes.
Judge Elias.
Yes.
Judge Ellsworth.
Yes.
Mr. Fox.
Yes.
Judge Herman.
Aye.
Justice Hall.
Yes.
Judge Jackson.
Yes.
Judge Kaufman.
Yes.
Justice Miller.
Yes.
Mr. Robinson.
Yes.
Judge Rosenberg.
Yes.
Justice Cantil Sakaue.
Yes.
I should say, Chief Justice. It's unanimous.
Well, that's a round of applause.
There's a standing ovation
Thank
for those
you.
Who are listening.
And I say there's one person who I might have overlooked and never intended to, Zlatko.
Yeah.
Thank you for your reason.